Put yourself in this man's place. Now, I don't know a lot about New York City muggings, but I don't think they're normally pulled off with three guys with automatic weapons and with a new, modern, expensive vehicle that you get shoved into. If I were a federal prosecutor and that much happened to me, by the time I got into the car, number one, I would think it was much more than just a robbery. Number two, I would think that I was not going to get out of it alive, particularly if they were not wearing any masks or anything like that. I would think I would be moments away from the next life, moments away from the next part of the story. We'll be right back. Well, once again, Stanley, I'm not an expert in this sort of thing, but most muggings are, you know, a knife in the ribs or a gun and then a grab and a run. Not three guys, automatic weapons, new expensive vehicle, all that sort of thing. I mean, it must have seemed at the very beginning like an awful lot more.
It sure did. It was absolutely overpowering. And you're right. A typical mugging, you know, you hand over the money and then they run away and and it's over. This was something totally different.
Well, so then running through your mind probably was it involved your job and I'm dead.
The thought that I possibly be dead was definitely there from the start and really never really went away for the whole ordeal. The job part, I think it was pretty obvious to me once I was in there and hearing them talking about taking me to the bank and PIN numbers, it seemed to me that it was a robbery. And then it was a robbery that morphed, you know, because as I mentioned, they took me to the bank and you know, I've got this big chunk of money sitting in my savings, basically my life savings sitting there, and they've got a $1,000 limit on the cash machine card. So that's when they changed their plan. Instead of just taking the guy to the cash machine, now the plan was, let's keep him. Let's figure out how to get all this money.
Okay, so they didn't take you to get at least the first $1,000, or did they?
They did. They drove me to a cash machine on the corner of 23rd Street and 6th Avenue. Leader of the gang goes in. I'd already taken out $200 because the following night I was taking my friends out for my birthday to see the musician at the Bottom Line. So it was only $800 left to take on the daily limit. The leader of the gang got that, and then he's trying to figure out other ways he can steal from me. You know, basically came up with this plot. Well, let's take the guy. Let's kidnap him. Let's blindfold him and take him to our apartment. And, you know, and then in the morning we'll take him to the bank and force him to turn over his money.
Okay, so they blindfolded you so you wouldn't know where their apartment was, but not so you wouldn't see their faces.
Well, that's right. I mean, this was not necessarily the MIT of robbers.
Yeah. I think I've got that.
You know, and their plan was, you know, was hatched sort of on the spot. Now, as I mentioned to you, I purposely kept my face down in the car, and so that I wasn't looking at them. I didn't want them to think that I'd be able to recognize their faces.
Yeah, but not by their order. I mean, this was your own thinking to sort of look down, right?
That's right. That's right. You know, it was instinctual, and I got to tell you, if you grew up in New York City, you develop some pretty strong instincts.
Sure.
About crime, because you kind of get used to it. You know, I've got some of the vignettes from what happened to me and my brother and other family members growing up in New York are in the birthday party. Some of them are not in there because there wasn't space for all of them in a 300-page memoir.
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, once they blindfold, I mean, there was 10 minutes where I could have spotted their faces, and the blindfold really was just keeping me from seeing where they were taking me.
All right. Well, were you nevertheless putting together in your mind a mental picture of what you could see and remember just on the off chance that you would live through this?
I mean, one of the things that's real interesting, I think I don't want anybody who's driving right now to do this, but anybody who's at home in a safe place, if you close your eyes for a few minutes, you'll see that you can see a lot with only your ears. It's amazing what you can pick up through your other senses besides sight. And so, you know, once I was blindfolded, I just went into that mode. And I, the one thing that's really interesting also is that, you know, I think none of us really knows how we're going to perform when we're challenged in this way, but you have extraordinary strength in you when you have an emergency like this happening. And I was very focused. So I was listening to everything that was happening. Anytime I had the chance to sort of negotiate for my life by being polite or giving a decent answer that wouldn't make them angry, I would do it. And I also started gathering clues from the minute I was in there.
Uh-huh. What kind of stuff were they asking you anyway? Obviously about the money, but what other stuff?
I mean,
obviously they asked, what do you do for a living? I'm a federal prosecutor. Okay, boom.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm an assistant U.S. attorney. And one of the things that's really that I like about my own book is that it's both incredibly scary and also really funny. I mean, these guys are actually trying to relate to me and figure out what was going on. So, you know, they're like, you know, you got a wife? No. You got a car? No. I live in Manhattan. Who has a car? Right. You know, you're 38 years old? Yeah. You got a girlfriend? Well, I casually dating someone. I wasn't going to tell them that. No. Okay. So Stanley, you got all this money in the bank. You're 38 years old. You're not, you ain't married. You ain't got no wife. You ain't gonna, 'cause what the hell have you been doing? to which I responded, you should ask my parents. They've been wondering the same thing. So, you know, and it's real interesting. I mean, them having me in there, you know, they started to sort of play with me and kind of get to know me, you know, sort of find out what my life was like. And you know, so there's some real interesting interactions. And I think that my instinct was to be as nice and polite and decent as possible. There's no way I was going to, like, bust up and say, hey, if you guys don't let me go, you're going to be put in prison for the rest of your lives because I'm a federal prosecutor. I wasn't going to do that.
Good thought. But I mean, after all, kidnapping, robbery is bad enough, but kidnapping, particularly of the kind where you're blindfolded and taken somewhere, that's a big offense.
It's an extremely serious crime. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is I want people to understand what it feels like to be the victim of this kind of a violation. It stinks. You know, like you said before, you have a mugging's over in 5 minutes or less. You know, the thought that you have to go through hour after hour, it's kind of psychological torture of knowing that people who couldn't care less about you can just end your life on a whim. This was real psychological torture for a lot of hours.
Did you were you able to figure out whether these were killers?
When I got, you know, they blindfolded me and they drove me to an apartment. I wasn't quite clear where. It seemed like it was somewhere on the Brooklyn-Queens border. When I got there and they were talking to me in the beginning, they kept calling me Steven. I kept saying, my name's not Steven, it's Stanley. And they were laughing. They were like, oh, yeah, that's the guy we did this to the other night. Now, that the couple of guys that they'd done it to before, they had not taken to the apartment. They'd only taken them to the bank, gotten the money, and then they'd let them go. So I knew from what they told me that there were other robberies involved. As to whether they had killed somebody, I never knew it. I still don't know it for sure. I pretty much doubt it. I think these guys were, you know, this was like a startup venture. You know, they were just getting going.
God. So it never occurred to them to, I don't know, put stockings over their head or anything at all that would hide and prevent a description, an accurate description, from being given to the police.
Well, in the beginning, that's right. I mean, the one guy had a knit cap down to his eyebrows, so there was some hiding, but not much. I still saw his face. And as I say, I kept my face away. And then once they decided to keep me, well, then they had the bright idea of using a blindfold. So at that point, they did it. But no, in the beginning, they were just... Because, again, you got to keep in mind that their plan changed. Originally, it was just a quick robbery that was going to be over.
So, in other words, you're driving around in this car, and they're making the plan as you go?
That's right. That's right. This was This is the gang that couldn't shoot straight. I mean, the leader of the gang was a fairly intelligent guy. He was I learned this later. He was attending college. Actually, one of the things he was studying was criminal justice. And, you know, so he was a pretty smart guy. He had a job. He had a fiance. The other two guys were thugs, you know, basically the heat, guys carrying the guns. In the apartment, you have to understand also there were four more people. One was the guy who rented them the space in the apartment.
Wow.
And then there were three girls there, and I say girls advisedly, 16-year-old prostitutes.
Yikes.
The leader of the gang is their pimp. And, you know, they come over and they look at this well-dressed man who's sitting there on the mattress blindfold, and they say, "What the hell are you doing? What did you drag home, boys?" Because, you know, really, these guys hadn't thought about it in advance. They just kind of did it on the spur of the moment to get at my money.
Okay. So you had what, a few a few hundred thousand dollars or something in the bank?
I had about $100,000 that I saved up from working at my law firm job for a few years.
Okay, so when you told them that, that's when the other plan began to form, I guess. What was the plan? What were they going to do? Next day, have you go to the bank?
So the idea was that in the morning, they were going to drive me. The first idea was to a drive-through bank, and then they decided it would be at a regular bank. They would drive me to the bank, and they would be waiting outside the bank with their guns, and I would withdraw $50,000, and you know, they would shoot me if I didn't do it. You know, then they were talking about maybe one of them would come in the bank with me. Then when I got to the apartment and they were pointing the guns at my head, they were saying that they would blow my brains out if I didn't cooperate. You know, "Stanley, you ever seen one of these machine pistols? All I got to do is pull this trigger, bam, 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 your brains will be all over that wall." But then they came up with a threat that was even worse than what I'm describing, because they told me that if I didn't cooperate, they would go to my father's apartment and kill him by breaking every bone in his body.
Oh, God. I was going to say, otherwise, just taking you to the bank under any circumstances and letting you walk in is not too bright, because you'd just stay there.
Well, that's right. And as the night went by, they eventually realized that the plan didn't make any sense and they changed it. But that was the original plan. You know, when they made the threat to kill my father, I got to tell you, that was probably the worst moment of the whole thing.
Sure.
You know, you can kill me, you can beat me, you can do anything you want to me, but the thought of somebody doing it to someone I love was just, you know, beyond horrifying. Just absolutely beyond horrifying.
So they made you tell where your father was, or they found out somehow?
So, you know, sometimes in life, Art, you do things that you think are good, and they end up coming around to bite you. I used to carry my father's business card on me. He was pretty much retired, but he was a cantor, which is the Jewish guy that sings in the synagogue, and he would marry people. You know, he married thousands of people in his career, so he kept a business card in case somebody, you know, needed for him to officiate at a wedding.
Sure.
And I felt that by carrying the card in my wallet, that I was sort of, it was like almost a good luck charm. I was helping my dad by carrying his card in my wallet, kind of like, you know, being proud of him. And it turns out, you know, we had his home address on it. So from that card, they could know where he lived. So as I say in the book, what I paved with good intentions became a road leading to hell. Because the thought that they would use that and go to my dad's was just devastating.
So they kept you on a mattress blindfolded the whole time?
That's right. That's right. They brought me into this crash pad apartment somewhere on the Brooklyn-Queens border. As I walked in, there was clothes on the floor. I could feel a lumpiness as I walked on top of people's clothing. They put me down on a mattress. You know, they wanted me to take off my shoes, which my instinct was not to do it. I thought, you know what, in their minds, they should have the idea that I'm going to walk out of here. And I didn't want to take off my shoes. And I kept my jacket on the whole time. And I sat there on that mattress for the next 24 hours or so.
So you refused to take your shoes off?
Yes, politely. You know, I was like, you know, "Stanley, why don't you take off your shoes?" And I said, "Well, thanks, you know, but I'll keep them on." You know, politely.
Yeah. And I'm sure you were sitting there, what, all this time? 25 hours, I think this went on, right?
Yes.
So you must have been trying to figure out how am I going to escape, or can I escape?
You know, there's a moment in the middle of the afternoon. The thugs who had grabbed me on the street had gone out for the day. I didn't know exactly what they were doing. I learned later that they were using my credit cards to buy things. And there was the last guy there, the fourth thug, whose apartment it was. He was guarding me the whole day, and the three girls were there. And so it was a quieter time, and there were fewer people that could have killed me there. And you know, I ran through my head, maybe I ought to try to either convince them to let me go or just kind of run for it. And it didn't make any sense. If I had made a move for the door,
Yeah.
you know, I might have just ended up getting whacked in the head with the gun. You know, not even killed, but hurt. And it just would have spiraled downward.
Could you see anything at all with this blindfold on, or was it really effective?
So it was my own scarf that they blindfolded me with. And when they brought me into the building at first, I could actually see out the bottom of the blindfold, and I saw the pattern of the tile in the building that they took me into. And one of my favorite parts of this story is when I got out, I described that for the FBI and the NYPD. Well, guess what, Art? Within 48 hours, there are FBI agents out in that neighborhood going building to building looking for the pattern on the tiles that I had described.
Wow.
So that I love about it. And then when I got inside, I couldn't see out of it. There was one moment again in the afternoon when I was just with the one guy and the girls that he left the room, and I could tell that there was nobody else in there but me. And I just creaked my head back and looked out the bottom of the blindfold, and I could see just a little bit across the room, and I could see a little kid's red fire truck. You know, it looked like it was a place where a kid really lived.
Right.
And then as soon as the guy came back in the room, I snapped my head back down and I didn't try to look again. You know, it was important that they not think that I could see out of it.
Were your hands free?
My hands were free. Yeah, they actually, on the way back to the apartment, they bought duct tape to tie me up, but
Right.
I was so cooperative that they never bothered to use it.
I suppose that's the way to be. Did that cooperation really pay off? I mean, it relaxed them apparently enough so they didn't do that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know what? After I got out, I read an article that I talk about in the book that describes what you're supposed to do in a hostage situation. And a
Right.
lot of what I did on instinct was sort of just the right thing. You can't get anywhere by challenging them. You have to be cooperative, put them at ease. It even says you ought to use humor after the first hour because that may help. Again, you have to be very careful how you use it. You know, I think being polite, keeping them calm was the best strategy. And frankly, by the time we were done with the ordeal, I think they really didn't want to kill me. I think they kind of liked me. There's some funny parts where they start suggesting that I ought to join their gang and recommend friends that they can kidnap. You know, because you know we're starting to get this is after I've been there about 20 hours, and they were actually, you know, these guys were smoking marijuana, and then they had these prostitute girls there, so they were one of their fringe benefits in this startup company of theirs was that, you know, they got sexual favors from the girls.
I see.
So I, you know, I can and I I'm blindfolded, thank God for the blindfold, but I could hear what was going on around me. And after they've smoked pot and they've had sex with the girls, they're kind of relaxed. So they started playing with their new toy, which was me. And they're like, you know, tell us about your law career. Oh, by the way, would you mind giving us some legal advice? I have this problem, I have that problem.
Stanley, hold on. We're at a break point. Stanley Alpert is my guest. This is Coast to Coast AM. My guest is Stanley Alpert, and his book is The Birthday Party, a memoir of survival. Indeed, so. You know, you can perhaps we're, I don't know, a little used to all the violence since it's all around us, but I can assure you, if something like you're hearing about tonight happened to you, you'd probably figure you were dead. We'll be right back. Well, okay, Stanley, this ordeal went on for about 25 hours. Remind me of about what time, was it night when you were grabbed, right?
At 11 o'clock at night.
11 at night, all right. So, let's see, 11 at night. So, really, I don't know when banks start the new day. Do they begin it at midnight? Could they have gone back, taken you back for another 1,000 after midnight, or what?
That's exactly right. And they had my PIN number. So they went sometime after midnight. They went back to a bank in their neighborhood and got another $1,000. And then when they kept me for an additional day, one of the reasons they kept me all that time was to get the one last hit after midnight again. When you know, right around the time they dropped me off.
Sure. Okay. Well, yes, but their plan had been sometime, I guess, during the day, to either take you to a drive-up or into a bank, and they were threatening to kill your dad. What became of that part of the plan?
So as the night goes on, the leader of the gang, who's gone out to visit with his fiance, the other two thugs are sitting there and they're discussing the plan. They're saying this isn't going to work. It's going to look really funny for the three of us, you know, to go to a bank with the Caucasian and try to withdraw a large sum of cash. We're going to get caught. And I actually kind of sort of helped them along with that by agreeing that the last time I tried to take a lot of cash out of the bank, the manager came over and all that. When the leader of the gang came back in the middle of the night, they tried to convince him not to do this plan. And eventually they did convince him to do it. One of the interesting things is, they hadn't quite focused on what I told them about being an assistant U.S. attorney yet. So the leader pops his head into the room while they're having their little conference, and he says, "What did you say you do for a living again?" And I said, "I'm an assistant U.S. attorney." And he says, "U.S. Oh no, the FBI is going to be after
him." Well, the FBI is going to be after him anyway. This is what, at least the third kidnapping they've done.
Well, the third bank robbery where they held people at the bank, at least. This is the first sort of larger kidnapping, take the guy to the apartment. They've never done this before.
I see.
You probably would have been prosecuted by the state at that point. Nobody had crossed state lines. Once you start messing with the federal prosecutor, you know, and making it into a larger bank robbery, which is what my thing became, you're running the risk of a federal prosecution. It turned out on this one that state sentences were a lot higher, so they ended up getting prosecuted under state jurisdiction.
So anyway, they talked the leader out of the idea of taking you to the bank.
They talk him out of it. So at that point, his plan at that point was to actually take me back to where he'd gotten me that morning at about 9 in the morning. And he told me that's what he was going to do. But then hour after hour went by and the leader of the gang doesn't come back, and nobody who's guarding me has any idea what happened or why he's not coming back to return me. And as you can imagine, I was petrified. There's nothing like being told you're going to get released.
Right.
And then waiting hour after hour with no explanation. I didn't know what was happening to me. I didn't know when they were going to come back and just stick a bullet in me.
Right. Right. And I, you know, that would be my thought. I mean, certainly you had seen their faces. You probably could identify them. You probably did identify them in the end, didn't you?
I went to lineups, and I actually, you know, I told you I was looking down in the car so that they wouldn't think I was able to recognize them. I had a feeling I could recognize all three of them, but you know what? I was wrong. But I did pick one out of the three in the lineup. The one guy in the car who was the most violent, he kept putting the gun in my face. Every time he talked to me, I was trying not to look at them, but I kept glancing up. He was the one guy who hung tough in interrogation. He wouldn't give the whole story up like the others did. And he's the one guy that I managed to successfully pick out of the lineup.
Huh. How did you get released? Did they just... I mean, to me, if you're gonna grab somebody as they grabbed you, now they've got nearly a couple of $1,000 of your money. So it's a big crime, kidnapping, all the rest of it. It's amazing to me they just decided to release you. What did they imagine would happen?
Well, I think that a couple of things happened. One is that they had bonded with me. William Grimes, writing a review in the Times, said, you know, that I induced reverse Stockholm syndrome in them, you know, which I just love, that he said that. And I think also, before they released me, they actually, the leader of the gang, asked me if I had the chance to put him away for life, would I do it?
Yeah.
You know, what do you say to that? If you say yes, you're dead. If you say no, you're dead. I mean, how stupid are people, right?
So what did you say?
I said, look, you know, you already told me you know where I live. You know where my father lives. I don't know who you are. I don't know where we are. You haven't hurt me yet, and you say you're going to release me unarmed. I don't think this has to go any further.
That's good. Actually, that's very good.
That was my answer. And you know, he was kind of satisfied with that. He was like, well, all right. And, you know, I think also, in addition to that, I think they realized that they had a hot potato at this point.
Sure.
I mean, kidnapping a federal prosecutor is bad enough. And certainly, I convinced them that they probably wouldn't get caught. But if they had murdered me, I mean, you know, you might face a federal death penalty for killing somebody because he's a federal prosecutor. So they had a real hot potato on their hands. I think they needed to let me go. And you know, the other thing that's very typical in any criminal gang, anytime people are involved, somebody's going to give it up at some point. If my body had ended up in a dumpster and nobody found it for a month, and then one of those girls got picked up on a prostitution charge and somebody starts leaning on them, somebody was going to give it up at some point. That's just the way it happens.
Now, speaking of the girls, they offered you one of the girls, didn't they?
Well, they did. When they found out it was my birthday, they thought that was very funny that they had kidnapped the MF-er on his birthday. And they said, you deserve something nice for your birthday. How about a blankety blank for your birthday? And, you know, at this point, that sounds, you know, quite humorous. But at the time, it was just frightening because I couldn't really afford, while being held at gunpoint, to be violated in that fashion.
Right.
You know, nobody thinks a man can be raped. You know, like, or maybe there's something funny about that. But the fact is, when somebody's holding a gun at your head, the last thing on earth you want to think about is sexual contact.
Absolutely.
So luckily I managed to sort of dodge that bullet. You know, I was afraid they would think that, that I didn't like their girls, you know, and I had nothing against their girls. I just didn't want to be, you know, forced into sexual acts at gunpoint.
Oh my God. So you kind of made friends of them.
That's right. You know, by the time we were done, they were suggesting that I join their gang.
Join the gang.
They actually said a couple of times that it was a shame we had to meet under these circumstances, that if we if we'd met under different circumstances, we could have been friends. And you know what, Art? The funny thing is, in some strange sense, they're right. If we had met under different circumstances, we could have been friends. You know, I'm pretty open to different kinds of people. I grew up in New York City. You know, I'm sure I could have been friends with these folks. The problem is we didn't meet under different circumstances. We met where they'd made a choice to try to ruin my life by holding a gun on me, by threatening to murder my father, by throwing the fear of God in me, by causing me extreme trauma, by taking the chance of killing me. If I, you know, if anything had gone wrong, they would have killed me as quickly as you might squash a bug.
Sure.
And so we didn't meet under different circumstances. And so I'm really happy, of course, even though, you know, I sort of get the point, I'm really happy that the justice system has put them away for a really long time because it needed to. We need these people off the streets because these are dangerous people.
So what did they do? Just drop you off roughly where they had found you or what?
There's a moment in the book where I'm actually pretty sure towards the end that they're actually planning to kill me, and I try to describe for the reader what it's like the moment you know that you're about to lose your life.
Right.
But I was wrong. Thank God they actually were not planning to murder me, and they drove me to Prospect Park in Brooklyn, which is quite a distance from where they picked me up, and let me off there. And they let me off blindfolded. They told me to just walk. I took a few steps, and I didn't know where I was. I thought maybe I'd end up in a river. So eventually I stopped walking, you know, with my hands up, you know, like some kind of a scene in a movie. I finally said, "Are you there?" And nobody answered. I spun around. I pulled off my blindfold, and God had given me my life back. They were gone.
All right. But at that point, now, remembering they had your dad's address, they certainly knew where you lived. So you've got to think pretty hard before you pick up the phone, don't you?
You're absolutely right. I raced over to a pizza place in Park Slope, you know, the first place I could find open at that hour.
Sure.
And begged the guy to use the phone. And, you know, New Yorkers are kind of a tough bunch, so he was looking at me like I was crazy. And he almost didn't want to let me use his phone. But the first phone call I made was to my dad because I wanted to see if he had been harmed.
Right.
And I was also afraid that they would go to his house and try to hurt him.
Of course.
So that was my first call. And, then, you know, his phone line was busy. I called some other people. I ended up back calling my dad, and he told me that, you know, he was okay. And, you know, but I should call my apartment. And, you know, in my apartment, we already had FBI agents and detectives who were already looking for me.
Oh, really? How did that happen?
I said, please send somebody over to guard my dad.
Oh, okay.
Until
all right, so you called the FBI. The FBI was one of the calls you made right away.
Well, I don't know. I didn't call them. What had happened was, you know, it was my birthday, so my friends were supposed to be meeting me that night. When I didn't show up, they flipped.
Okay.
So they end up coming over to my apartment to see if, you know, maybe somebody's bludgeoning me here in my room. And I'm not here, and they see my answering machine's going off. So they play the answering machine. And on the machine are two bone-chilling messages. Number one, Mr. Alpert, there's been unusual activity on your cash machine card. Please call the bank immediately. Number two was from some lovely woman in a neighborhood called Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn who had found my credit cards on the street at 7 in the morning.
Wow.
And, you know, some of my friends are prosecutors, so it doesn't take them too much time to put this together. Their buddy's been missing since at least 7 in the morning. He hasn't shown up. Nobody's, you know, he hasn't called. He doesn't show up for his birthday. There's been unusual activity on his cash machine card.
Got
my
it.
Friends were pretty sure I was dead.
Yeah. Yeah. And, so the decision really was made for you. I mean, the FBI was already there. It was already in motion.
I got picked up in Park Slope by the FBI and the NYPD.
Wow.
Yep. They came and got me. You know,
And then you've got this decision. Of course, they're going to ask you right away. And I guess you just decided to open right up. Or did you pause and say, look, I don't know really whether I want to talk about this or not?
You know what, Art, I talk about this in the book. You know, if I had ever given it a moment's thought to not speak openly with the police, I had a moral obligation to prevent them from doing this to the next guy.
Right.
You know, and you know what the funny thing is? Actually, you know what? This is a part of the book that got edited out because it was too much of these stories about what was happening going on up in New York. And I had the same experience growing up in New York. There were guys on a subway train that tried to set me and my friend on fire.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, literally, six of them, you know, let's set these guys on fire. Because New York was kind of the Wild West in the 70s. And, you know, I ended up getting a cop to catch all of them. And my friend said, we better not go to court. And I said, screw that. We're going to court. I'm going to get these guys. People can't do that to people. I think it's real important. I know people are a little afraid at times, but I think it's real important that people make the justice system work. You have a moral obligation to the next person who's going to get victimized. And the other thing, of course, is once the FBI and the NYPD are interviewing me, you know, if I lie, it's a criminal violation.
So, well, that's of course true. But now going back for a moment, before they released you, did they issue any threats about what would happen if you talked?
No.
No.
They didn't.
Okay.
In fact, I think that they had been convinced by what I just mentioned to you that, you know, probably they had done such a good job with the blindfold and not telling me where they were that probably they couldn't get caught. So I think I sort of put their minds at ease as to, you know, whether they were going to get caught or not. No, they didn't threaten me at all about going to the cops.
Okay, so you talked right away, and apparently you told them about this floor that you saw. How long did it take the FBI or the NYPD to gather them up?
48 hours.
48 hours.
Within 48 hours, I was of course in a safe house. I wasn't staying at my apartment because I was afraid
Right.
they'd come try to kill me. I'm staying in a safe house at a friend's in Upper Manhattan. And within 48 hours, the lead detective on the case calls me to tell me they're starting to round them up. I got to tell you, Art, that was one of the most thrilling moments of my life.
I
One
imagine
of
your
the things I
dad
say
was
is,
also, wasn't your dad protected also?
my dad was protected by the FBI. He had agents who stayed with him the whole night, that night that I was being interviewed. One of the funny aspects of the thing is that the FBI and the NYPD interviewed me that night, and they didn't tell me this at the moment. I learned this many months later, but my story was so crazy that they actually thought I made it up.
Really?
Yeah. This, first of all, kidnapping in the United States, this kind of thing is very uncommon. There, in New York, you hear about it sometimes with drug gangs that maybe somebody's girlfriend gets kidnapped as revenge. This kind of thing doesn't happen. It's a very serious crime. It may go on south of, like in South America or Mexico, but not in New York. Second of all, the details with, the guy gets kidnapped on his birthday. They're offering him sexual favors. They're telling him to join the gang.
Yeah.
The whole thing made no sense.
Well, did they hint ever with their questions ab about what they thought your motive would be for lying about all this?
Yes. What the police say is that in their experience, a guy's doing something, he's where he wants to be. He's either out buying drugs and he gets rolled, or he's out cavorting with prostitutes and he gets rolled. There was a very high-powered lawyer in New York about 15 years ago who got murdered in a motel room in the Bronx because he was with prostitutes. Or there was a gay party going on in the West Village,
Yeah.
and if I was at that party and I wanted to cover my tracks, I would come up with this kind of an elaborate story. Those were their ideas. Those were their thoughts. And, even though they had those ideas, of course, starting in the morning, they had to investigate. It wasn't long before they found out that their ideas were wrong. And in fact, the details I gave them started to add up. So they quickly in the morning realized that I had been telling them the truth.
Okay, and then you decided to write a book about all of this. Now, not a lot of people r would write a book about something as frightening as this, an incident like this. They just wouldn't write a book about it. What made you do that?
Well, you know what? When I first started it, the story was so life-altering and also crazy with so many twists and turns that I just thought it had to be written. There's another thing on a personal level. You go through something like this. Everybody's shocked. Everybody talks about it for a few weeks. It's just like the news media, though. After a few weeks, the whole thing kind of dies out and you forget about it. There was a feeling in me that this was such a life-altering experience that it needed to be recorded, that somehow, it would not be right to just sort of let it go. And the fact is I didn't do it for this reason, but once I did it, it was cathartic to write the book. When
Sure.
you write about something, you kind of give it up. So it actually helped me psychologically to write the book. And you know what? Also, Art, having written it, I realized that there are some important reasons why people ought to read this book. People ought to get what it's like to be a victim of a crime, because we need to fight harder in this country to stop it.
There's a lot of anger, involved afterwards, isn't there?
Huge amount of anger. Now, I had an advantage that not everybody has, which is my guys got rounded up within 48 hours and they got put away for really long prison sentences.
All right, hold tight, Stanley. We'll be right back. I'm Art Bell.